You're the guy who yelled that, right?
Yeah.
I don't blame you. Okay.
How much do you accept the melody at home?
Most of the time. I think it's just because Earl did it that way, or does it that way, I should say. You copy so much from Earl, it's like the guy you learn English from. You know, you just have to do it that way. If you're going to make up some new words, great, but you're still speaking English, you know. So, it depends, you know. It really depends on what you want. Sometimes, like... That's how loud I played that thumb. It wasn't the melody. That's another one. It's subsidiary to the melody, which is being played on other fingers, and it just depends. Because you try to get away from thinking about the technique that you're using. You know, when you say your name, you don't know what your mouth is doing. You don't know what your tongue and your teeth and your lips are doing. A speech analyst could tell you, but that's not the way you learned it. You learned it by hearing it and saying it back, and then they said it back and forth, and your ears have some great connection to the musical part of your brain, and that sends a message to your mind, I mean to your fingers, and then you just obey. So a lot of the stuff that you do, I mean, if you do an imitation of somebody, you don't know what's going on, you just hear their voice in your mind and you reproduce it. So that's the way I think most people play music, and it's actually, I think it's a very rare person who has the technical prowess that Bill has in terms of the way he thinks about music. He sees this gigantic web that he can dance around on, and of course Barry doesn't have access to that web because he only has that thumb mainly to work with. So he makes do, and of course he's got a great gig in Mountain Heart. And there's times when the fifth string is normally, which is a thumb string, obviously. It's usually played in a blending kind of way. The thumb is pretty far out from the bridge, and it doesn't ping that hard. But when I was working on Turkey in the Straw, I started saying, why doesn't this really sound like Turkey in the Straw? And it's because when my thumb played an important note on the fifth string, right on the beat, it was playing it the way I usually play, which is too quiet. So I said, I'm going to have to emphasize that note. And I practiced a loop featuring an emphasized note. And I found just for that one note, I'd pull my thumb back closer to the bridge. And that's the kind of detail work you do when you're really trying to get something together.
Would you demonstrate that?
Well. Sorry. I'm terrible at melodic stuff. There, is that good? If I was going to do it, if I knew I was going to do it, I would have practiced it. Man, would it have been great. It would have been just so great. Just so sorry you weren't there when I did know it really well a couple of years ago. But anyway, yes, another question.
It's like half a tune request, half a question.
Okay. Yeah.
Those are both kind of solo, and you always seem to have really good rhythm. So when you practice those, do you concentrate on making the rhythm really hot and play well?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you my little metronome story. You know, I always knew it was important to play good timing. I mean, generally that's understood, although there was years when I was really into what my good hot rise buddy used to call doodly-doo, which is... see how many different notes, be surprising as much as you can. And there's some great players who play in that style, in the doodly-doo style. And Charles would respect those people, but he says, there's an awful lot, this festival has too much doodly-doo, you know. And so I was doing that, and then I heard J.D. Crow one night, that was actually 30 years ago. And I said, that's the reason I started playing banjo, was the way he was sounding. And if you talk to JD, I went right up and started talking to him after the set, and he said the word timing about every five words. He's all about timing. And he could listen to a guy for a whole set, and then if he makes a timing mistake, he'll say, that guy you don't have the timing, you know. And if you listen to JD, you know what he's talking about. He's got it. And that is a Jimmy Martin thing. Most anybody who's ever played with Jimmy Martin's got that timing thing, and you have to listen to Jimmy's guitar, and that's your metronome. But then in conversation with John Hartford, he was talking about all this. He'd gotten into using a metronome. And he learned that from Buddy Emmons, who's one of the world's greatest musicians. He's the steel guitar player, which is an amazingly complicated instrument. And he said, well, Buddy Emmons sits around with a metronome. He just plays against the metronome. And he started doing it, and he's liking it. I'm thinking, John Hartford needs a metronome? I mean, he has such perfect time. Oh, that's right. That's why he has perfect time. So I got out the metronome, and in fact, I later bought a rhythm machine, the little thing that was small enough to put in my case, and you could carry headphones with it. And most pro musicians I know do metronome timing. And you just do that enough, and after a while, you just know what the beat's going to be like. And it doesn't mean that's the only way to play. Like if you actually timed out flat and Scruggs, there's times where the whole band relaxes going into a vocal, and then charges back up to timing, but it's always locked in because they're listening to each other. And there's one Hot Rise cut that started out at 144 beats a minute and ended up at 156 beats a minute, which was very scary when we go in mixing, going from the end of the tune back to the beginning and say, you know, and I finally timed it, I said 14 beats a minute difference. And then we listened really hard for where that happened, and we couldn't find it. That was good, because we were just in a constant slow acceleration that way. So anyway, you care enough. You know, one of the main things about musicianship is if you care enough about it, if you think it's important, and you believe in your heart that it's important to playing good music, that caring will lead you to a whole set of things. You saw what Barry had to do compared to what Bill Keith had to do. Two completely different banjo players. With totally different mindsets, and it's great to get some of each of their mindset when you're out there. But this is me, by the way, tuning it to C, which is the Ruthie key. Yeah, they're almost here, right?
I don't want to interrupt you, but yeah, they have right beside me here. Okay. I want you to play another
one,
but I want to make sure people know who's on stage today. This is Dr. Banjo. And he's also the banjo player for Hot Rise. 15 years, the president of the International Bluegrass Association.
This is what I really love, is just being with people and playing bluegrass. If it hadn't been for some lucky breaks, I'd be a sociologist and this would be my weekend, and I'd probably be here either way, but.
Any sociologists here?
We actually, in the record, put it down to B-flat, but using the same tuning lowered, because Alan O'Brien, who is the singer of the song on the record, preferred B-flat, so. That even lowers pitch, and this is having to retune all four, five strings. A full step, yeah, it's in B flat when you hear it, but it looks like this. Well, this is just standard banjo tuning, except I've lowered the fourth string to a C. So then you just take each note, the C becomes B flat, the G becomes F. Just two frets down the scale, that's the name of each note. My mom died in 1992, and my father was just, you know, really alone. And so I was hanging out with him, and he liked it when I just mess around on the banjo. He used to like that when I was learning, when I was a kid living in the house. So I just started goofing around in C, because it gives you such a nice low sound on the banjo. Sorry about this. And I found myself making up a tune, and this is it.